I'm not sure that I've ever talked serious about with anyone about their epitaph, pithy or otherwise, but I've definitely talked to plenty of folks, including a number of you, about their obituaries. That is, the things that they, I mean, you want to have said, and the things that you definitely want not to have said. The important milestones to lift up, the makings of a life that is, and in that moment, anticipating the eventual past tense, the life that was yours. These conversations, they often start off practical and reasonable and eventually end up tender and vulnerable, often with tears. Even the most stoic Unitarians, the scientists, even the men, I mean, especially the men, especially when done in the presence of children or grandchildren, those who might someday be the ones that will submit this text to the funeral home or the newspaper. Now, if we stay in such a conversation long enough, make space for the real to show up, it is often a conversation of hope and fear. Hope, that is, that we will have lived a life of meaning and purpose and connection, a life of love. And then fear that we will die before what actually is part of the conversation. Because talking about death is inevitably also a conversation about life. Death is, after all, a part of life, not separate, not other. As Joe said last week, every being has their first and their last breath. The obituary tells the story of these two things woven together. No more hiding or pretending that we are somehow outside the circle of mortality. As our faith tells us, we arrive from the same source and we share the same destiny. We are all in this together. Now, many of us struggle to know what we would want our obituary to say. But underneath that is the even harder struggle, that is admitting what we're afraid it should say if it told the truth. Hearing the list from Victoria of her possible epitaphs, I admit more than one makes me cringe in recognition. I'm guessing I'm not alone on that. Despite the challenges, though, the obituary is actually one of the easier parts of conversations around the end of life. Harder happens when we start to talk about how we will handle the serious illness or chronic injury. That is, how we will handle the decisions that inevitably come up along the way, the sort of decisions that ask us to consider what is critical to life and what is critical and unique to our life. What makes something our life? What are the things that we would say when these things are no longer possible? It's time. Our answers to these questions are, in their own way, a non-bucket list. Rather than listing off the things that we would want to do before we die, we start listing off the things that we must do in order to keep living. Most of us start on these lists with the basics of the body's function, like breathing, eating, communicating, just moving. We try to say what our line is, like life, not life. Same with the heart. After the body, same with the heart. What are the heart's basic functions? Connecting with friends and family, our partner, our children, with beloved animals, with nature and the earth. What it means to be loved and to love. Always on this list, there ends up being something related to, we must have a way to give back. Now, a few weeks ago at the start of this series, To Love What Is Mortal, did you forget we were in a worship series? I know time is funny, and also keeping track of things over time is even funnier. So if you forgot or maybe didn't know in the first place, we were in the end of a series on what it means to love, knowing that life will end. We're exploring life and death and grief and loss, and also how we go on, and how we change and life changes. So a few weeks ago at the start, I quoted Henry David Thoreau, you know, that 19th century transcendentalist Unitarian who went to live in solitude, famously, at Walden Pond. And so that he could, this is a quote, front only the essential facts of life and see if he could learn what it had to teach, and not, when he came to die, discover he had not lived. He says, I wanted to live deep and suck out all the marrow of life, to cut a broad swath and shave close. Now, it probably comes as like basically zero surprise to you that as a teenager, although I did have posters from magazines ripped out of David Bowie and Rob Lowe and like Vogue era Madonna, I had those on my wall. My real obsession was actually with Henry David Thoreau. That's the non-surprising part. So much so that the phrase to cut a broad swath was the title of my college entrance essay. Looking back now, I cringe to not quite the same degree as I do when I look at Victoria's List, but still my cheeks flush at my earnestness. And all the ways I was entirely wrong about what it really means to live deep, and all the things I incorrectly assumed would be the essential facts of life. This is how it always is, though, really. In these conversations about like where we consider what it would mean to live fully, what is essential, where we anticipate that line is between life and not life, we can't ever really know what it is that we will be able to adapt to after all, where we will be able to find life still in the shifting sands, or how our understanding of what is essential to all of life, to our own lives, how this can transform as we transform. In his book chronicling his life after his diagnosis of ALS, it's titled, We Know How This Ends. In his book, Bruce Kramer reflects on all the many ways that people tend to talk about end-of-life choices in a way that makes his life, the life post-ALS diagnosis, especially towards the later stages of his disease, how these conversations make it seem like maybe he's living something less than life. It's what he calls, quote, temporarily able-bodied bias. Because it's the way you see things when your body can still do or can now do what most bodies can do. And when the frame for the essential facts of life are based entirely on what your life actually is right now. But the thing about life is that it does change. It always changes, often dramatically, sometimes in a moment. Sometimes nearly everything that we counted on as critical to life turns upside down and inside out, and we're not sure how or when or even if it will change back. In such moments, I mean, in a moment like this, we are faced with a decision. We can make a bucket list of sorts of all the things that we want to do later when we get back to living for real. Or we can call this life here and now. We can find the essential facts here. Even though the world is constantly tender and terrible at least twice a day. But, I mean, that's how life is all the time, isn't it? I mean, that's the part of my high school obsession about Thoreau that makes me blush. That is that I didn't get yet how the essential facts of life include heart-shattering and trembling anxiety and the grief that you carry in your gut. And that's if you're lucky, because that sort of grief only comes when you've loved that deeply, that hard, that real, when you've lived that well. My dear people, I don't know how long this is all going to go on like this. I mean, really, none of us do, obviously. I don't know what's going to happen when the restrictions loosen in the coming weeks. I don't know when we can, me and my partner, when we can sit down with my partner's parents once again and plan out the next few months, because the world will suddenly appear once again predictable. And I don't know when we're going to be able to gather again in a room with all of us in the same room, all of us breathing together, singing together, not recorded, but live. I don't know when. And I don't know yet how to bear the grief or the anxiety that comes when I start to think about all of this just a little too closely. There's a lot that I do not know. And still, through it all, most days, most of the time, I do have the sense that we can keep fighting for life even here. We don't have to wait for some other life or some other time. Even here, we can find a way to love, to be loved. We can keep finding ways to give back. Humans are so resilient. I mean, even if it doesn't feel that way, you are so resilient. We are so resilient. Resilience, after all, it turns out it is a collective practice. Resilience is a communal practice. So together, in this big change, and as life continues to change, we can find the blessing that is here. In this, the broad swath of life running through our living rooms and our backyards, across our kitchen tables and through our computer screens, the non-bucket list life that is essential. Here and now.